That's a pleasure to talk today. As Joe said, I will be talking at the ITP colloquium, and there I will give a more general talk about other Josephson circuits. Today I like to focus on our specific research, what we are focusing on now in Delft. And let me particularly mention the people. There are more people and newer people also, but the measurements that I show, Caspar van der Wal was very important, and then a lot of other people, Frank Willem for the theory, Kees Hermans for experiments, and Alexander Tahar, quite a few people involved. And we all do this together with MIT. What I try to do today is talk about our qubits, our quantum bits, but the effects that occur there, talk a bit about what we observed, talk about relaxation and decoherence rate, some miscellaneous things that we think of doing, and then also I would like for the first time, because that is something I am working on here, and actually the idea grew here, to talk about what I call aluminum pi junctions, and you'll see what it is later. Okay, anyway. So, just to give a very short introduction, in these Josephson circuits we have, I hope most of you know it because I'll be going very fast here, we have two variables, the phase and the charge, and we can play with them if we have a piece of superconductor. Number of Cooper pairs in the phase are conjugate variables, there are the usual uncertainties, and the phase we play with by applying flux. If we have loops, the phase is very important, and the charge is the charge, the number of Cooper pairs on islands. So these are the practical things. So usually if the Josephson energy is much larger than the charging energy, we work in the phase space, these go together, and here it's the opposite. Now the types of quantum bits, or the type of quantum systems that we concentrate on in Delft now is a loop, and it's in the phase regime. And that is on purpose because we suspect, and this has never been proven yet, I mean it's a practical matter, that the noise in phase, in magnetic flux, is smaller than the noise in charges. And this is something that is determined by materials processing, but in practice we all know and see that the charge noise is very strong. There are many charge defects that charge and decharge. There's a lot of 1/f noise in charges, whereas the noise in flux that we see is smaller. But in the end, what the best solution is depends on fabrication and on materials properties. But okay, we have chosen to work.
Are you making this statement specifically for the point where the system is unstable versus plus minus one electron?
No, in general. So if you work, let's say if you have a quantum bit that operates on n is 0 and n is 1, the number of Cooper pairs, you always work in the transition region, and the charge noise will lead to dephasing at least, and also relaxation, but certainly to dephasing. Let's say because your quantum bit entangles with the charge defects, so information leaks out to these defects. Yeah. Okay. So what we do is take a loop, put it about half a flux quantum through the loop, and then we basically have two states that change the total phase in the loop by 2 pi. So you should remember in the whole talk that the flux is not conserved in a loop like that. The loop is weak. We have an aluminum film, and the penetration depth in these films is much longer than the width of the sample. So flux penetrates all the time. But still, the superconductor remembers what the number of fluxons, the number of 2 pi's that are enclosed in the loop. So if we go around the loop, the superconductor knows whether it's all the phases add up to 0, or they add up to 2 pi or minus 2 pi. These are significant differences, and that is what we use. Now, in this system where we have three junctions in a loop and a fixed fixed flux. We have two independent variables. This is the energy as a function of phase. And then what we use are two minima located there. And this is a cross section. So we have something like that. And this barrier, we can now manipulate the strength of the barrier depends on the value of the junctions. If they are all three equal, this barrier is equally high from this minimum to that, equally high as that barrier. To really decouple from the charge noise, we like to make this barrier higher, and that we do by making one of the junctions a bit smaller so that this one is smaller.
So this picture assumes that once you determine gamma 1 and gamma 2, gamma 3 is determined.
Yeah. If there's no inductance, it's just adding this up. It has to be equal to 2 pi f, and let's say the 2 pi times the flux divided by the number of flux quanta, plus n times 2 pi. Yeah, that is fixed. Yeah. Okay, now this barrier we can make small enough so that there is quantum tunneling between. And the strength of the quantum tunneling depends, of course, on the mass of the particle. The mass of the particle in these circuits is the capacitance of the junctions. So it's the electrical, the electrical capacitance. If that is large, tunneling is small. So we need a charging energy, which is the inverse capacitance, to be significantly, not too small. So if the junctions have a large area, the capacitance is big, charging energy is small, then we have small tunneling. But if the mass is small, we have easy tunneling. Now, the advantage of a loop with three junctions is that we can engineer the barrier any way we want. We can put the lowest states in these wells way up here so that there is not even tunneling if the charging energy is high. But if the charging energy is low, we can put it down. We can also change the height of the barrier by changing this junction. And this is much easier than if you use just one junction in the loop, because then you have to include the flux generated by the current, etc. And it's very difficult to get into the regime where you have easy access to good parameters. So having the three junctions helps a lot. Two is not enough to make yourself independent. So it's either one, but then with a large inductance, or three or more. And three is the simpler version. Yeah?
Are you calling out and in because of what?
Okay, out and in. We have a unit cell in phase space. Everything is periodic in phase space in two directions. If we tunnel only in the unit cell, that's one thing. And we can also tunnel outside of unit cell. So this is what I call out. If we can tunnel here, we can also tunnel there, and so we can keep moving. And that means that we can build up a large phase difference in time. The phase can grow in time, which means that it couples to a voltage. And that means that it couples to charge noise. So if we...
The choice of the unit cell is dictated by the fact that the out has higher barrier.
No, the unit cell, of course, is fixed just by, 2 pi. This is just the 2D letters. Yeah?
It's quite arbitrary.
No, it's periodic, so a unit cell is pretty clear, I would think. Rerun zone type thing in the 2D lattice. That's what I mean.
So I don't understand why Qin is different from Qout.
That is because this barrier is higher than that. And this is just a plot. If I calculate the Josephson energy, so no tunneling yet, just the energy as a function of this phase and that phase in this loop. Now it turns out that the height of this barrier depends on the strength of the junction. If that junction is equal to the other two, then these barriers are equally high. But if we decrease this one, in fact, if alpha is smaller than 1/2, there is no barrier in this direction. So there's no barrier here, but there are barriers there. So what you get is channels here. Okay. Now, we don't have only two states, obviously. there are other states. We have this potential well, we have higher states. If we do a fuller calculation, this is what it looks like. So this is the type of energy levels that we speak with, and we use this narrow region here. So this splitting is smaller than the next one. But this is a matter of numbers that we put in. We have to make sure, because if we do it wrong, then this splitting could be comparable to this splitting. And we want to keep the third level as far away as possible, obviously. It also limits us in how fast we can drive the circuit. If we put a step function flux change in, for instance, we might excite higher levels. So we have to be careful there. These are practical values that we use. I mean, the loops are something like a few micron square. The tunnel strengths we make something like 1 gigahertz. This is a typical value, let's say up to 20 gigahertz level splitting. If we go away from the center, these are, I mean, pretty large joules and overcharging energy. And the flux generated by the persistent current, the two states corresponds to currents clockwise and anti-clockwise. These currents generate a flux of order 10 minus 3 flux quanta. So a small flux, but big enough so that it can be measured and also can be used to couple to other systems. So these are again, I mean, this is in the middle. The two levels have equal energies. Here one is lower, here the other is lower. This is the ground state. This is the circulating current. Lower here, I mean, this is negative here, positive there. And this is this is for the ground state, for this one. The current is a derivative of the energy, and for the excited state, it's the other way around. So if we sit in the middle, we have a circulating current zero. I mean, it's an interesting point to work at, but there's nothing that we can measure. There's nothing to couple to. But here, there is.
So, is this for, you change the directions by changing the applied flux or by changing the relative
No, we have always two states. There are always two states, but let's say if the flux is on the left here, one has lower energy and on the other side, the other has lower energy. Yeah? Okay. To do a measurement, we put a squid. A squid is a loop with two junctions. I mean, this is just a typical squid that we use. And we measure the critical current from here to there. And the critical current depends on the flux in that loop. And the flux is now determined partly by the qubit inside the squid loop. So we have a rather tight coupling, as you can see, of the squid to the qubit. The squid itself, if you look at it, these junctions are actually smaller than the qubit junctions. And the qubit junctions are weak junctions because we need low capacitance and we need to get the tunneling. So the squid is even weaker than the qubit. And that is to reduce the back action from the squid to the qubit.
The squid only measures this 10 to the minus 3.
It has to measure 10 minus 3, yeah. But, okay, I'll come to that. But this is a difficult balance that we have to make here. If we make the squid good and we couple it very strongly, there's a lot of back action. We can also choose a stronger squid but weaker coupling. I mean, there's a whole range of possibilities, and this is not so easy. What we do now is measure the critical current by a repeated measurement. 10 minus 3 flux quanta is something you can easily measure with a good squid, but not in the time that you need to measure it, like a nanosecond. You can do it if you have a full second available, but we don't, obviously. So the trick is now to do a repeated measurement, like 5 or 10,000 measurements. And what we get is a histogram we ramp up the current of the squid, we measure the current where it switches. The switching current depends on the enclosed flux. We get a histogram, and the histogram, in fact, is much wider than the signal of the qubit. About, as I put here.
Each measurement is a very short one?
Yeah, I mean, we ramp up the current, but the ramping goes quite slow, in fact, at this time. But somewhere it switches, and then we measure a voltage, and then we register the current where it switched. But each measurement then does not give us whether the qubit is not a real measurement on the qubit. We need an ensemble measurement, an ensemble by repetition, to get enough information about the qubit.
I mean, each measurement like that is a sort of an integral over the persistent current, an integral over the persistent over time, or integral over the flux generated by.
No, I wouldn't say an integral. The switching current of the squid depends on the enclosed flux in the squid. And that in turn depends on the state of the qubit. But there is a certain probability of switching. It's not, I mean, so that is why we have this white histogram. Anyway, now this is typical. Now you have to remember each point here is an average over a histogram, average over 5 or 10,000 points again. So to sweep this takes maybe 1.5 hours or so. Yeah. And this is now what you see here is the switching current. You can see the step, and that is the step where we make the transition. This is half a flux quantum in this in the qubit. So we make the transition. The ground state now goes from this current to the other current, and this is the total reversal of the qubit current. And what we also have done now is, so we have put a microwave signal, continuous microwave signal, to the system, and if the microwave frequency is resonant with the level splitting, so that happens on both sides, has to happen on both sides, then we see transitions. And as you can see here, we see a transition here, and we see the opposite transition there.
Yeah. What is this resonance?
This? The width? Okay, so that's the next question. Why does it have a certain width here? Now the answer is, I'll come to that much later in the talk, the answer is that our flux is not constant enough. Our flux in the actual system is not constant enough. We have a flux variation in, I think, but it's hard to be sure about that, in an external flux of about in the order of 10 minus 5 flux quanta. And that.
The answer to the question is, for you it's probably obvious, is that the point at which this happens, let's say,
the point where this happens. Okay.
The point where the difference. Equals the microwave frequency.
Yeah, the microwave frequency is fixed, and then of course, if the level splitting corresponds to that, you expect something to happen, and that is what happens. Now, if that is what is happening, it means that if I change the microwave frequency, the peak has to move. Yeah. And then, it does. So we have the two peaks here. If we decrease the frequency, these peaks move towards each other, as they should. Yeah? And this now we can use because we know the microwave frequency. Because we know the microwave frequency, we also know the level splitting. I mean, we measure the level splitting. So we measure the level splitting as a function of the applied flux. And that is what we plot here. And we get this line. And then what we see is this deviation from the straight line to the origin. If we blow it up near here, I mean the deviation from half a flux quantum, there's a clear deviation. We can estimate in a conservative way what the error is, and there's a significant deviation. And that we claim is proof that we have a real quantum superposition of those two states now. And this was also seen about the same time in Stony Brook in a similar system, but that was a squid loop with one junction, a slightly different system. But anyway, they also, and they saw a superposition of two excited states. So the third level in one well, I think, is the fifth level in the other, a crossing of those, because it's different to work in the ground level there. Okay, but anyway, they saw that. So what we see here is a quantum superposition of these two states, and there's not so much more I can say about it, although you talked about it for a long time before I came, I understand. What we have here is a system where we have about a billion Cooper pairs. It depends on how you approach it. In one way it's a billion, another way it's a million. But anyway, it's a large number. So we have many Cooper pairs, and they all participate. So in this state here, in the middle, we have that all the Cooper pairs are at the same time moving in this way and in that way. The whole system is in that quantum superposition. So it's not that half the Cooper pairs go this way and the other half go the other way. All the Cooper pairs all go both ways at the same time. And now the question that arises many times in discussions is whether is this now a Schrödinger cat of a million or a billion particles? And I would think it's not, because these particles are not free to do what they like. It's more like if you talk about the spin of a large atom. And in a cobalt atom, for instance, you have maybe 100 nuclei there, or I don't know, many anyway. But in the end, there is one spin property. So we are all used to consider that as a single unit, a single quantum unit, that spin of that cobalt atom. In this case, the single unit happens to be something that is composed of a million or a billion Cooper pairs. But the Cooper pairs cannot choose to be different one from the other. So it's not, I think, a Schrödinger cat of, let's say, a billion in Cooper pairs separate units. And this is something that...
control the tunneling between clockwise and anti-clockwise and see how this curve line...
In principle, yes, but... we haven't done, let's say, 10 different samples and seen, but this is in very good agreement with what we calculate. I should warn you, I mean, there are many, many suggestions that are easy to make. A measurement like that, to make one sample, a good sample. Sample is three levels of fabrication, it's difficult. To if you know what you want, and you have a good student or a good person, it takes about 3 weeks if everything works. But the typical turnaround time for thinking of a new sample and having it is allowed more like 2 or 3 months. To do the measurement and to get a consistent set of those points also takes months, weeks to settle the system, etc. So in practice, to say let's now do 5 or 10 different samples and see how this gap here depends on J over EC and all these things, I mean, that would be a full PhD program for a student. And it's not the most exciting thing to do. So there are many other things you want to do. So I hope many other groups will do this and fill it in and prove that it's really true. But we would like to go on to newer things rather than...
I just want to make sure I understand that this situation cannot be viewed as a macroscopic situation, but it really is a transition between two...
It is a macroscopic system,
but
for sure.
Still two bona fide quantum states.
Yes. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, that is what I would. It's two bona fide macroscopic quantum states. But.
The question that the people here were very excited about is what about the relative phase of these two states? What is the time that it takes for this relative phase to dephase? So
the dephasing for this system.
Yeah, because you obviously rely on the fact that there are two quantum states, each state has a phase.
Yeah.
And the relative phase, if the relative phase would be bad after a picosecond, then obviously it would be bad.
No, it's, as I'll show.
How long it takes was the question that...
Now, at this time, in our system, it's a few nanoseconds, but we cannot prove that it's better than nanoseconds, but it should be much better. I'll come to that. Yeah. And I believe it is much better. But there are...
What you're saying is that this is a sort of ground state, so it's not a matter of...
This is ground state. This is
ground state.
Yeah.
Now
we measure ground state, but we do that by having quantum transitions, because we measure the level splitting. Because how can you measure? You have to measure something relative to something else. So we still measure the level splitting. Yeah. But it's a ground state property that it curves. Yeah. Okay, it's gone already. Yeah.
But this ground state, I just want to, for theoreticians, this ground state is a superposition of two, to make a macroscopic states, because it's like
those states. Yeah.
And that superposition assumes that those states are there, and the phrase is determined.
Yeah.
And then one could discuss what's the decoherence type for the relative
within that state
of the two components of the ground state. So. And that's at least the question. The answer is.
If the dephasing is the phasing rate is very high, you would not see the superposition. And in fact, I mean, like in NTT, they rebuilt the system. I mean, made the same samples, and they don't see this. They don't see transitions between the states, and they don't see the curvature. But they do see histograms. But they are separated, but they have strong, I think at least one explanation for that is that they have strong dephasing still.
Yeah. Will it be fair to say that when you have the ground state, of course you have an excited state, which is, let's say, the symmetric and anti-symmetric combination of these points.
Yeah.
And then, as you said, as you hinted, there is some broadening into all kinds of processes.
Yeah.
So as long as this broadening is smaller than the splitting that you have found, then you can still prepare the system in the ground state and it will stay there basically forever.
I want to speed up a bit because I want to talk about newer things also. Measuring we analyze, it's very important that what we have is the loop, squid, internal variable, external variable, and then the environment. And when we ramp up the current, we couple more and more strongly to the environment. So this is a complicated process, and I think we will change it by, instead of using the switching current, measure the inductance of the squid, which is also a measure of the strength of the superconducting coupling. This is the type of analysis that we use to analyze the decoherence and relaxation rates. And as usual, I mean, this is the Grifoni-Henge type approximation, Milena Grifoni and Frank Wilhelm worked this out for our system. It depends on the spectral density, and the spectral density depends on the model for the environment. So what kind of oscillators do we have? And the relaxation rate in particular depends on the spectral density at the energy splitting. So we have to make sure that that is small at our 10 gigahertz. And we do that, I'll move on, by reducing the external. So what we did is put a capacitor here that is coupled. The squid is like an inductance. So this circuit has a very low resonance frequency and is far below our level splitting. So that should improve, according to the calculation, should improve our relaxation time. Trouble that we didn't realize at that time is that we made this of superconductor, and I think what is happening is that we trap flux in this big superconducting flaps, and that will give us flux noise, but that I come to later. So this is what we calculate for a system. So this is what we should be able to, if we make good circuits, etc., this is what we should be able to do. That is that these are different. This is for our present system that still has impure aluminum. So, but this we can get rid of by using pure aluminum. The squid system itself leads to relaxation times of rates, let's say the dephasing times of the order of microseconds, and these are long times, I mean huge times. So these are should be no problem at all. And then putting the RF excitation circuit. Anyway, there should be plenty of time. This is the most critical one, dephasing time. But actually what we get is shorter. And we measured the relaxation time, and we did that. We didn't manage so far to get Rabi oscillations, to get pulsed measurements. We are trying, and are trying still, and it will come. But what I have in terms of results are measurements where we pulse the microwaves, but keep doing that all the time. And then measure what the response is. How, let's say, as we increase the waiting time, if we make it infinitely long, obviously the signal will go to zero. because on average there's little excitation and it dies off after here, and there's a long time when there's nothing. So now this is a way to measure the relaxation temperature. This is what we measure, and then we can fit that. And what we find is that these are measurements at different frequencies. And what we find is that even with times in the order of 4 microseconds between pulses, we still see spectral lines. And if we do a fit, we find that, let's say, the relaxation term in this case is of the order of 1 microsecond. This is not an intrinsic time, because we have changed trivial things in our circuit and seen this relaxation time change. So it still depends on the way our electronics is put in. And we think we know why, and we are changing that, but you know, so a change like that, as I said, takes many months. So we know this since July, but we don't have a new measurement yet.
You mean both temperature electronics or on chip electronics?
Both. Actually, we change something at room temperature, and so the relaxation time change. We know that if we understand well what is going on, the next sample will have something on chip. But that sample is not ready. I hope it's ready this week or next week or ready. I mean, people are working on it, and if it's ready, we'll put it in. And that will have more damping near the qubit itself. Okay, this is another measurement. Now, what we find in practice is that we are limited clearly still by flux variations. If we put just a squid there without a qubit, or the qubit is there but don't in a situation where it's not doing, or actually this is with the line, we use the qubit also as the detector. But anyway, we find this kind of noise, and if we compare that, we can see that the total width of our spectral line is in agreement with the measured flux noise. And we have noise on shorter times and also on bigger times. So these are variations, and we don't know where they come from, but we suspect it's due to trapped flux in our magnet. It's a weak magnet, but it's still superconducting wire. We can, for instance, replace that with normal metal, and that would take that away. We also have a superconducting shield. So we are looking at all these aspects. And also, as I showed you, we have this superconductor shunting capacitance. And that is a stupid thing, and the next sample won't have that. So we think we can reduce this. And as I said, this is... We cannot exclude, of course, that there is an intrinsic dephasing time, but it's so clear that we see flux variations that I think it's still due to that. Now, I want to show you things that happen if we increase the microwave power. And this is something that I would like you to react on and think about, because this is a problem that we have. Or a problem, it could also be fun, I mean, it could be interesting. So this is what we see. If we have a certain this is all measured at high powers and different frequencies. And as you see, we see these lines, the ones that I showed you, let's say this one and that one, but now they are wider. If we increase, I didn't show it before, but if we go from low power to high power, the lines broaden. They get wider and wider. And what we see is that we see the basic line, but we also see the double freak, I mean, one at a double energy, where the energy is twice the frequency, and three times, as you can see. But we also see subharmonics. We see resonances where the frequency is twice the level splitting. And that is not so easy to understand. So any of you that has a good idea to explain this, I would be very happy if we can talk.
What half, meaning that the energy is half?
Yeah. The energy here is half the frequency. Energy here is 1/3 of the frequency. And this is unusual. I mean, higher harmonics are... Any nonlinearity will give you higher harmonics, but subharmonics are a bit more difficult to get. But, I mean, they're there. I mean, it's clear. I mean, you can see many of them here in particular, yeah?
So how is the higher power that we apply?
Oh, just, I mean, the coupling that we have, the microwaves application is now well controlled. We use coax lines and on-chip coax lines, so there's very strong coupling.
Is it coherent? Well, can I consider it?
Sorry, I don't know exactly what this means, what you say, because I think it's well defined and coherent. I mean, the microwaves by themselves are I mean, keep going in time, and the phase is well controlled. It's a well controlled oscillator that keeps its phase better than our system. Yeah. Yeah. And actually, to get the microwave level right, we have to put in a lot of attenuation because we have strong coupling. So this is just a matter of cranking up the knob of the generator. That gives us enough power. No? Okay, let me talk about a few other things. Qubits can be coupled, and that is just the inductive coupling. We can increase, I mean, just putting them next to each other will give a certain amount of coupling. I mean, typical levels are 10 gigahertz, and typical tunnel strengths are 1 gigahertz, so this is very small. We put a loop around, we get something like that. But we can also just have them share a leg, and we can in the leg put a junction when it's even stronger. So we can increase coupling, we can make very strong coupling. We can make the coupling, the qubit, the J if you want, stronger than the delta, the level splitting, the tunnel splitting, and also equal to the actual level splitting. And we can in principle also put them in long chains, and we are actually making such chains and looking at, I mean, the plan is to look at phase transition, and Leonid Levitov has calculated properties of chains like that, and they promise to be very interesting. There's a special soliton mode that he predicts. And there are many variables, but we, to explore those, we have to make different samples, of course. We can change the flux, but once it's made, we cannot change the level, sorry, the tunnel strengths and the coupling. They are fixed. Okay, so this is one. Now, something else, and the quantum information people talked about adiabatic quantum computing yesterday. This system, in general, in the superconducting systems, it is also possible to do adiabatic changes and use geometric phases. And Fazio Falchi, people in Catania, did some work on this. And what they considered was a qubit system in the charge regime, where they have a Cooper pair box. This is a thing with capacitance driven by a gate, but it's also coupled to the strength, the Josephson coupling, which is the one that gives the tunneling strength between the two Cooper pair states here, is now coupled to an asymmetric squid. And now if they change the flux in this loop and the gate in a certain sequence and make a loop, then they pick up a Barry phase. And this is a Barry phase that can in principle be used also as a geometric quantum computing system, and by coupling the systems it can be conditional, so it can in principle one can think of controlled knots. Now in our system we have even wider possibilities. This is not something we will do soon because it's very difficult, but on paper this is doable. I mean, I showed you this picture where we have the phases and the minima here and we tunnel there. Now if we make our qubit with three junctions and we make each of those junctions a squid, now we can externally change the flux in a loop like that. So we can change the strength of this junction or of that junction or of that junction. And that, as I told you, corresponds, let's say if we change this one, it corresponds to changing the barrier here. But if we change that one, it will correspond to that barrier. And if we change the other one, it corresponds to that barrier, this and that, the other. So we have, in principle, the possibility to change one barrier after the other. I mean, take this down, put that up, and things like that. And in principle, now we can start here, move there, move there, move there, move there, move around the circle. This is a series of sequences to do that. So we do that by changing the barriers. Let's say here we have strong coupling in this direction, So if you sit here, and then of course we can also change, I mean, one level lower than the other, while the barrier is low here and high in the other ones, we can go from this situation to that. And that is how we change, move from here to there. So from move from here to there. So we do this bumping and then also change the barrier. So once we sit here, we increase this barrier, then decrease this barrier, and then we can go from here to there, etc. And this way, one can pick up a much larger geometric phase than is possible. The other possibility that corresponds to the Catania scheme is just move around in this circle, make a circle in this minimum, a certain circle here. But as you can see, this is a much larger, in principle, you can make it even larger, because you can move in phase space in a controlled way on paper. I'm not sure we can do that in practice, certainly not at this time. Okay, now I would like to mention this aluminum pi junction, and because I'm, as I said, working on it here, and I think it should work. We haven't done this. Some of you may know this proposal by these people there that proposed to make a qubit using D-wave superconductors. And the advantage of using a D-wave superconductor is that you have a built-in pi phase difference if you use two different phases of this YBCO or something like that. So as has been proven by Van Harling in a measurement. So if you connect a squid loop or a superconducting loop to two different phases of the crystal, the D-wave crystal, you have a built-in pi difference. So you have no noise, not the noise that comes with having an external magnet. So this should be a stable pi bias. Of course, you still have a loop. So if there's external flux, you still have, if there's flux noise, it will still couple into that loop. But the first half flux quantum, you get free and stable in this case. Yeah? Okay, now in practice, of course, it's not so practical to make small, controlled, high-quality junctions on D-wave superconductors. That may take another 25 years before that is possible. So this is not something one can do. But what we can do and will do now is the following. We take a superconducting loop, an aluminum loop, and typical values would be thin film, 40 nanometers, a width 200 nanometers, just aluminum. And if we put that to low temperatures, it's a weak superconductor, but still pretty strong on the scales of what we talk about. So it means that penetration depth is long, so flux will go in and out. But as I said before, in those loops, the winding number, if you want, let's say the phase number, this number n, I mean the total phase, if you go around the loop, always has this possibility, 2 pi n. This n can only change by what is called phase slip. A phase slip requires that the order parameter goes to zero over the whole cross-section of the loop. And to go to zero over the full cross-section of the loop, even in this very, I mean, weak aluminum wire, corresponds to an energy of 40,000 Kelvin. So that is pretty sure that it won't happen. So now the point is, if we cool this system while we apply a flux, let's say this is the total phase difference. Beta is connected with the, but it doesn't matter in practice so much. This is what counts. If we cool it down while we have one flux quantum in this loop, the flux quantum, I mean the n, the system will, while the energies are still low, will choose to have n equal to 1 to minimize the energy. So if you cool it down in a field that corresponds to one flux quantum, you will build in this n is equal to 1, and that will have a low energy. Now, once you're at low temperature, you take away this f, but n still has to be 1, because to deviate from that has a penalty of 40,000 Kelvin. It requires phase slip. So what we have is a built-in phase difference of 2 pi in this loop. It's not quite 2 pi, it depends on this parameter. Yeah? And this is easy to make. We make it all the time, but we never did this trick so far. And then if we couple, now if we take this strong loop compared with our junction systems. It's a very strong loop. Critical current is in the order of milliamps, and the critical currents here are half a microamp, so there's three orders of magnitude strength difference. If we hook this up, there's very little effect on the loop, but this loop picks up this phase difference, but also because there is a persistent current in this strong loop, it also picks up flux, and it turns out that what happens is that you pick up just the phase difference. I mean, if you take a quarter of the circumference, and if you've loaded this with 2 pi, you pick up a phase difference pi over 2. So you can connect it here in this way. You can also connect it here in the middle and connect it there, and you will have a built-in phase difference pi. And that, I think, will be a very stable one, because these wires, the width of these wires, 200 nanometer, is equal to the coherence length. So a vortex cannot be trapped there. So I think it will be very stable. But we still have to prove that. But I think it's a very stable, similar to what was proposed for the DVF superconductors, except this is something we can make now. I mean, it's available now. Now, the bad part is that we still have a loop here. I mean, we pick up external flux here, and I pick up external flux there, and that still matters, but let's see. I'll come to it. This is just a game. One of the students, just in the last month, has made some samples to test this. This is now such a loop. These are two junctions. So this is a squid that is loaded with pi over 2. He made a series, one that has connections here in the middle. So that should be pi, and this one, and another one with 0, etc. So now, just to test whether it works. And that will be, this test is going to be done soon. What is?
I mean, what you say is that the integral over the entire aluminum loop should be 2 pi.
Yeah.
But is it clear that each side should have pi over 2?
Yeah. No, sorry, it's a bit more complicated, but I don't have to, I mean, I need 10 minutes to do it properly, yeah? But, yeah, and I needed, let's say, a few weeks to do it properly, but anyway. And I think I understand it well now. Now, this is, for instance, how we can use it. If we think of the same measurement, we can take a pi bias connected to our qubit, and then we need a squid coupled to the qubit. Pi over 2 is a good bias for a squid. I mean, it's nice sensitive there. So this is a possibility to get that system. And that should be much quieter. But I think it can be even better. And I like this one very much, because in the last 2 weeks I discovered that it really works. And before that I thought it would only work in a limited regime of parameters. Now, what we also can do is take a strong loop, bias it with 2 pi, and then put our qubit, our quantum circuit, if you want, in the middle. And now this is a pi bias, and this is a gradiometer. So if the flux here and the flux there are equal, if there is external flux, and if the flux here is equal to that, it doesn't matter to the qubit. So in first order, if there's an external source of flux noise, I mean, far away on this scale, then it won't do anything to the qubit. And to drive the qubit, you have to make a flux difference, which is possible. You put something close by, and also to measure the qubit, because the qubit has a current this way or a current that way, that current splits in two directions. So you get half the current here, half the current there. But that also, if you want to measure it on large distance, there will be 0 magnetic moment. But it's, a loop is always a dipole, but this is, I guess, a quadrupole now. There's two different loops. For fun, one of the students made one already. It's not a good one, but this is 3 junctions, and this is a measuring squid, and that's a driving circuit. But this will also be measured. I think what we want to use it like is something like this. So this would be the qubit. We can bias it by having a bias, load it, drive it away from half a flux quantum by, for instance, this. And to measure it, we also have to measure a difference. but it's nice to keep it as symmetric as possible, but to put a squid here, the squid picks up its built-in phase difference from this loop also, and then we can measure the inductance. But it's nice to do it, even if you wouldn't measure on both sides, to put it on both sides and excite it on both sides to keep that as symmetric as possible. So the back action to the qubit should be very small. And this is also a nice system to play with, because if these are the two building blocks, these are the two states of the system, I mean, you can combine them in many ways, and they all couple. Let's say you can make chains, and this will be an excitation in the chain idea. So this is a quantum Ising system with quite stable building components. I think you could make 2D and 1D circuits very easily. And I think we will try this. Now, one last small point I would like to bring up. This is, can we on our systems do a single shot measurement? I talked about measurements where we do 10,000 measurements, in fact, an ensemble type measurement, more NMR-like. Can we do a quantum optics-like measurement, like a single shot? Now, one way to do it is to freeze, and that is doable by, I mean, I told you we can manipulate the barrier height for the tunneling of our system. So if we can do that fast enough, we can do a quantum manipulation, then increase the tunnel barrier, and then do the measurement, that sequence. And we've worked out in principle how it should be done. And to make a tunable barrier, this, as you can see, this together is the middle junction, that's the third junction. If we change the flux in this loop, and we can do it, for instance, with the control line here. That doesn't change the total flux too much, but does change the barrier. In that way, we can change it. So this is a scheme that's doable. But in the last few weeks, actually, last few months, but we've heard about it in the last month, several measurements have now been done in the system. And this is very interesting and very promising for the whole field, for our field. And this is now connected with what used to be known in the 80s, before ITC came and everybody started to do something else. People studied large, relatively large, many microns, Joulson junctions, biased single junctions, and these were actually the first measurements on quantum properties of such circuits or junctions. Now, the Joulson energy as a function of phase looks like this. So if there's no current, it looks like that. If a current is applied, we get what is called the washboard potential. This is for half the critical current. This is for a current very close to the critical current. So it is a very weak potential. So still the system can sit in a well. If you blow up the well, this is a blow up of this well, but this is a huge blow up. So there is still a well, but it's small on that scale. Yeah? But the system can still be trapped. And of course, if the barrier here is now small, so if the temperature is higher than the barrier, it escapes, and the actual critical current is lower than the official critical current. But if you take the system to low temperatures, it can escape. I mean, it has, depending on the capacitance, it will sit in this potential well, I mean, a harmonic oscillator state. This might be the lower state, it still sees a barrier, but it can quantum tunnel through it. And this has been measured in the 80s that happened. Now this has been revived by the same people that did the measurements in John Clark group in the 80s. One of them was John Martinez, and he's now with NIST. And he's now using this system in the following way. He takes one of those potential wells at a current near the critical current, and he uses three levels. And the potentials and harmonics, or level splitting, is not identical between the first two and the second two. Now, he sees this as a qubit. He has his two lower levels. He excites them, and he can do that by changing the current. And then, to do a measurement, what he does, he applies a microwave pulse, a short pulse, which is resonant with this level difference. So if, and to the extent that the qubit is in the top, in state 2, then it will be taken to level 3, and from there it tunnels very easily, because this tunneling is exponential. The tunneling probability is many, many, many orders of magnitude higher here than from this level, and certainly from that level. And if it's in this state, it's not excited. So this is a clear measurement. Now, it's not been, I mean, some initial measurements have been done and they look very promising. It seems to work. And I think this is a very nice trick to use. Now, at the same time, the people in Saclay, the Varin, Estève, Urbina, Fillon, and those people used a similar junction. Also, they were involved, Michel, Wilson, Clark Troop at that time in the 80s. Now, what they use it as a detector for their charge qubit. And what it can do is that if you have a, let's say if you bias it first at this current, and this is a blow up now for two values of the critical current, as you can see, if you change the bias current just a little bit, the barrier changes a lot. And the and tunneling, of course, is exponential in the barrier height. So changing the bias current by a little bit changes the tunneling probability exponentially, very, very much. So this is a very sensitive detector to a very sensitive current detector. And what they use is they make a closed loop. They have their Cooper pair box, and it's connected with two junctions, and the junctions are in a squid loop. And depending on the quantum state of the Cooper pair box, the current in the squid loop goes this way or that way. And that they couple to this junction, and they use this junction as a detector. And from their analysis, they find that it should be a single shot detector with an efficiency, I think, yeah. Anyway, so it should be reliable on the level of 95%, which is amazing. And they claim to have seen it on the level 60%, but now what they, and this is just something I heard 3 days ago, they have now seen Rabi oscillations with this system at a decoherence time of about 100 nanoseconds. So they could see 10 Rabi oscillations in the Cooper pair box in this system. It's a very nice system, but I don't have time to go into it. Because they have three connections to their system, and they can tune out, put it in a working point where the influence to charge noise is minimized, and also the influence of phase noise is minimized separately. And it seems to work. Now, we could use a similar trick. If we now combine, this would be the gradiometer qubit, and if we take now, let's say, one of those junctions also, we connect it weakly by putting two weak junctions there. So the states of the qubit are reflected in a current. The current that runs here, there will be a strong current running there, and a small addition due to the qubit up or down. So there's a small change in current here, and that will reflect in a small change in the current there. Now, if we drive the current, as the Saclay people do, we should be able to detect the state of the qubit also in a single shot measurement in a similar way. We could do that, and again, I think we should do it in a symmetric way to minimize the back action before we really measure something to the qubit itself. So we could run both, not necessarily read out both, but still do the measurement on two at the same time to keep it as symmetric as possible. So this is something that I feel is extremely promising, and we'll do that, I hope, in the next months. Unfortunately, on paper, everything goes infinitely faster than in practice, but still it comes. Thank you. This is what I wanted to tell you. Yeah.
How fast can that detector work with 95% single quantum detector?
You mean?
This is the detector that you mentioned.
Yeah.
In photodetectors, that's where I'm coming from. You have a trade-off between how efficiently you can detect photons and how fast you can do it. So I don't know if there's something in counterpart.
No, I mean, they claim that it's better than a photodetector. But I have a preprint, and I can look up the number. But it's fast, and it depends more on how fast you can wrap the current and read it out than on the system itself. But what the measurements they have don't have this number yet. I mean, that still has to be proven that is possible, this 95%, etc.
Okay.
But yeah. But still, it looks extreme. It's an extremely nice new tool for our game, and I think we can use it for all systems, like also for the phase qubit. It's not limited to the charge qubit.
One question about this last system is that you say it will leak out from this small well, but this assumes that all the other part is a continuum set of states. But you know, there it's all, the two is quantized and states are discrete. Has anybody discussed that?
Sorry, which, sorry, I don't...
When you tunnel out, you have to tunnel out from a small well into an infinite, into a continuum.
In this detector?
Yeah, in the last detector.
Last detector, no. Yes.
All this, if I understand correctly, is a circuit where you have a potential which is all finite, with all these discrete states.
Yeah.
So you don't really tunnel out, you just make a, superposition of a... tunnel out, you must have a continuum to tunnel into.
Now they try to limit, not let the system go all the way on the washboard potential, trap it after, let's say, 4 or 5 wiggles
right.
In a short time, yeah.
So then all this potential is really a potential box, it's a huge one,
yeah.
But nevertheless has a finite, finite level separation.
Yeah.
And, it's not clear what exactly should happen, it's not exactly tunneling down, it may be some kind of complicated quantum oscillation, so.
Anyway, if it can be detected, it does give a voltage pulse.
It does give a voltage.
And that is what is detected, and that is used as a signal. So the presence of the voltage pulse associated with this, let's say, wearing down this well in a short time, that pulse is detected. So whatever it's doing, as long as it gives a voltage pulse, it gives a signal.
Well, that's
right. Yeah.
Okay, let's thank Hans again.